It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, asks a number of very difficult questions about the future of our species and our planet. This hour, we'll talk about those hard questions and some equally difficult answers. With me today is author Alan Wiseman. He'll be speaking tonight at 8 p.m. at the Iowa State University Memorial Union in the Great Hall. Alan, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me, Charity.
Now, your last book was called The World Without Us, and it was a thought experiment in what would happen to our planet if people suddenly disappeared. And your findings, your research showed that nature is incredibly resilient. But of course, humans aren't going anywhere anytime soon. Were you already planning this book when you wrote the last one?
I was not. You know, some readers of that book know that at the very end of it, I launched another thought experiment. The whole idea of the world without us was not because I would like human beings to disappear. I am rather fond of my species. But I wanted to just theoretically clear the decks of us, show how well nature would do if it was relieved of the daily pressures that we heap on it, and then I hope to ask themselves, you know, well, is there some way that we can add ourselves back into that picture, only in a harmonious relationship with nature as opposed to the antagonistic relationship that we have right now? But in trying to write an epilogue to that book that would discuss, you know, how might we achieve a sustainable balance, I ran into a really disturbing fact that every 4 to 4.5 days, we're adding a million people to this planet. And that certainly didn't seem like a sustainable number. So at the end, I just sort of left dangling a question of, you know, what might we have to do in order to gracefully bring our numbers down to a reasonable level that wouldn't be destabilizing nature, before nature just does what it always does when any species has a population explosion, and does it for us. And the response to that book, you know, and I'm grateful that it was an international bestseller. It's out in like 34 languages. That many people wanted to talk about that very question that I'd unexpectedly put at the end of the book. And finally, I realized that this was an incredibly important question. I mean, it's obvious that all the environmental impacts that we talk about constantly are simply because there are so many of us impacting the environment. And yet you don't hear environmental groups, you know, saying that out loud a lot, because it's a very sensitive issue to attack, you know, the very people who you're trying to win over, to suggest that they are the problem. So I decided that someone who is not either pro-population control, which again is a loaded term, or against it, but a journalist, had to look at this thing dispassionately and try to understand where the truth lies. And that turned out to be easier said than done. This book involved much more research than I expected it would.
So lay out the picture for us now. We have over 7 billion, 200 million people living on Earth right now. Our population continues to grow. What is the trajectory?
Well, the trajectory is that we are headed, if we keep growing at the rate that we're growing right now, to just under 11 billion by the end of this century. And these numbers are getting more refined all the time. When I started doing this book, a lot of people believe that because the world is becoming more urban and urban populations tend to have fewer kids because, you know, you don't have a lot of kids, you don't have a lot of need for farmhands as rural populations.
Right. And you have less space for the children that you do produce.
Yeah, you're more crowded, and, you know, kids are not an economic asset like they are on the farm. They're a liability. They cost you money, and they're not big wage earners. And so there was a thought that things were going to level off around 9.2 billion by the middle of this century, and then we'd have a stable population. But the new data that's been now increasingly corroborated is that we are shooting beyond that. We're going to be over $9.5 billion by the middle of the century, and like I said, headed to $11 billion. But that's also an assumption based on current availability of contraception, which is the way that we do, you know, limit the number of births that we choose to have. One of the things that I found is that access to contraception is a very shaky premise in this planet, and that could change any time. A half a child more per woman, and we'd be headed towards $16 billion by the end of the century. On the other hand, if contraception were much more widely available, half a child fewer per woman, and we'd be headed to $6 billion, which would be back in the direction of sustainability.
And you say back in the direction of sustainability. Do you believe that our planet is overpopulated with humans right now?
Well, that's an assumption that I had to test out, you know, as a journalist. And a lot of my research for this book was talking to ecologists all over the world. I ended up going to 21 different countries to study this question. And I actually boiled it down to four questions. The first one being, how many people can fit on this planet before we start to tip it over? Well, there is growing concern among ecologists, in fact, not just concern, but conviction that we're already in that situation. The planet just seems to be bursting its seams. We are using, just our species is using 40% of the land just to grow food for us. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for the millions of other species that are out there. We now have a society that is thoroughly addicted to the most addictive drug of all, man-made energy. You and I are talking to each other via electricity, and you know, this just goes on and on. It's just pervasive, and except for a very few remaining hunter-gatherers on the planet. And we do wonderful things with concentrated energy. We propel ourselves. We have instant communications. But the downside, of course, is the waste products of creating that energy. And those waste products, you know, the ones that we're most concerned about right now, have to do with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And they're overloading the atmosphere to the point that, you know, everywhere I go, all those 21 countries, and here in Iowa where I am today, everybody's talking about how the weather has changed. Let's put it this way. There is more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now than there has been in 3 million years. And 3 million years ago, and the same scenario was 15 million years ago, and in both cases, the seas were between 80 to 100 feet higher than they are right now. And that's going to be a profound change when you consider how much of our population and our economy is concentrated on coastlines all over the world. How much of our food is grown at sea level, and how even if as our populations are growing, how vulnerable that food supply is to, as I saw in many places where I went for this book, saltwater incursion as the seas start moving up watersheds and making the underlying water layers too saline for plants to grow. So, and since I've mentioned the seas, also that excess carbon dioxide as it's being absorbed by the sea is changing sea chemistry. You know, we all spring from the sea. Our food chain all starts back there. And if we change the chemistry of the seas from something quite different from what allowed us to evolve, or our food supply to evolve, or the other species to evolve upon whose existence largely we depend, whether we realize it or not, this is serious business.
You cite the research of many different scientists, many different researchers, in trying to find that number of what is the Earth's capacity for human beings. And Paul and Ann Ehrlich are researchers that you cite who've been writing about this for many, many years, provocatively. Gretchen Daly's another one of the researchers that you cite. And they come up with a number that they believe is the capacity for humans on Earth that I was shocked. I mean, it's surprisingly low. Tell me about that number and what it means.
Sure. And I'll also say that, you know, the Ehrlichs, you know, Paul and Ann Ehrlich are famous for their book, The Population Bomb, that they wrote warning us of all these problems. And that book came out when the population of the Earth was less than half of what it is today. They and their colleague Gretchen Daly are not the only scientists who from other directions have arrived at a figure. And it's a figure that hovers around 2 billion people.
Two billion people, and we're over 7 billion right now.
That's right. You know, you were shocked when you read that, and listeners are probably shocked to hear this and shaking their head and saying, oh, that's crazy. But let me put it into this context. The human race, like every other species on this planet, barely grew, grew very, very slowly over 99% of its history. Because the way nature works is that organisms create a lot of copies of themselves. That's only nature. And a lot of them don't survive. You know, it's hard to understand that most people did not live to their fifth birthday until the early 19th century when, starting with a smallpox vaccine, great strides were made in medical technology. And people started living longer and infant mortality dropped severely. Happily, I should say. I mean, you know, nobody's against medical achievements. But then in the 20th century, things really changed because of increased food technology. By inventing artificial nitrogen fertilizer.
All right, we'll talk about the Green Revolution in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Alan Wiseman. His latest book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Alan Wiseman. His latest book is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. That's with a question mark, by the way. And he asks a lot of questions in the book, some very difficult questions about how many people the Earth can sustain, what we could actually do to control population in our species on this planet. How can we feed the people on this planet if our population continues to grow? And what are we doing to the rest of the creatures and natural ecosystems that we share our planet with? He'll be speaking tonight at 8 p.m. at Iowa State University's Memorial Union in the Great Hall. And Alan, just before the break, we'd gotten up to the Green Revolution, which, of course, many people in Iowa are very familiar with the story of the Green Revolution because an Iowan was key in solving some very serious hunger problems around the world. Of course, that was Norman Borlaug. And fertilizer was just a part of the key to producing a great deal more food to feed people on the planet. And at that point, we were at a crisis point. We were at a point where there were many people who were hungry and people were going to be starving to death if we couldn't figure out a way to produce more food. But even then, Norman Borlaug said, we're just postponing the problem. Are we reaching that critical point again?
Well, we are. You know, we have to go back just before the Green Revolution, right around World War I, when we invented nitrogen-based fertilizer. It completely blew the lid off of what nature could do, could produce much more plant life on this planet than existed before. And when it started to be commercialized, our population was around 2 billion people. Its use gradually increased and numbers of people gradually increased because there was more nutrition out there. But things started coming to a crisis point in the 1960s, and that's when the Ehrlichs wrote their book. And they predicted widespread famines in the 1970s, unless, as they said in their preface, an agricultural miracle took place. And that agricultural miracle, of course, was the Green Revolution that they didn't even know about, that it was about to pop. Norman Borlaug developed plants that could grow much more food per stalk of wheat or stalk of rice. And these new strains, with the chemical protections that they needed because they were laboratory bred, and the fertilizers that they needed, were shipped to India and Pakistan, the first two countries that were on the brink of famine, and they were, of course, saved from massive starvation. But when Norman Borlaug won the Nobel Peace Prize for being, because he was credited for saving more lives than anyone on Earth. In his acceptance speech, he didn't gloat about refuting the Ehrlichs or refuting Malthus. On the contrary, he said that they had simply, as you said, postponed a situation, and unless population control, and that was his phrase, worked in association with improved food production, that the world was headed towards a disaster. And he spent the rest of his life on the board of population groups. Now, I went to India and Pakistan for this book, and the result there, which Norman Borlaug predicted, was that as more people don't die of starvation, they live to beget more people, etc. India, in this coming decade, is going to surpass China as the most populous nation on Earth. And Pakistan is one of the fastest growing nations on Earth, and it's completely out of control. Pakistan right now has nearly 200 million people, and it's in a country about the size of Texas, which has 26 million. And by the middle of the century, if it keeps growing at this rate, it's going to have many more people than the United States today, and it'll still be the size of Texas. And it can't possibly feed and employ all of these people. And so you've got high unemployment, a lot of frustrated, angry young men, and it's just kind of a breeding ground for terrorism, as we all know, to our horror. And it's a nuclear power. India is running out of water for its Green Revolution. I spent a whole day talking to widows of farmers, Green Revolution farmers, who watched their wells drop from 50 to 100 to 500 to 1,000 feet at points where they could no longer afford to keep drilling that deep. And they commit suicide. This is a very shocking figure, but I corroborated it with the Indian government after I heard it from the Punjab Farm Bureau. Since 1995, 270,000 Indian farmers of the Green Revolution have committed suicide, and they do it by drinking pesticide. So the Green Revolution, unchecked, just creates populations that just keep riding ahead of the problem that it can solve. And now we have to do something about that. And what I really wanted to find out in this book was, is there a way that we can do something about it that would be acceptable to the majority of people on this planet?
Well, let's talk about population dynamics, because there are, obviously we are a global citizenry, but all humans live in different countries, and different countries have different policies, different countries have different cultures. And in some countries around the world, we do see population evening out or even declining as the birth rate declines. There are so many differences among all of these different cultures. When you looked at the places where birth rate has declined significantly, what are the commonalities that you find?
Well, I'm happy to say that I don't find commonalities. That's really a positive sign, because it means that in every different culture, there's a different approach that can work for that culture. Some of them are, based on their histories and their religious liturgies. What springs to everybody's mind immediately is China's one-child policy. And everybody hates that idea of having some government tell you how many kids you can have and that you can only have one. Look, the Chinese don't like it very much either. But I found in very disparate countries very unique and different programs that have not been coercive. They've been voluntary, but they've simply persuaded people that it would be in their own best interest to have fewer children. And I'm happy to give you a couple of examples.
All right. And I would love some examples. And I find it interesting. There are some places where people have been persuaded of that. There are also places where people have just decided that on their own. I mean, you have some wonderful examples. For example, from Thailand. I mean, let's talk about the persuasiveness in Thailand in convincing people to have fewer children. But I do think it's important to remember that there are some places where there hasn't been any government policy that has caused this result.
Well, exactly. And once again, whenever you can put this decision in the hands of people, as opposed to having a government telling them what to do, it's much more likely to be successful. In the case of Thailand, it had to do with an economist. Now, pro-growth economists oftentimes are against the idea of limiting population. They like the idea of there being more consumers out there, and they like having large labor pools, so that keeps the price of, you know, labor cheaper. But in the case of Thailand, an economist who was working in development programs and traveling all around the country realized every village that he went to was swarming with children, and there was no way any of these programs were going to be able to be meaningfully making any changes with such an excess of humanity. So he started combining his development talks with handing out condoms. And, of course, everybody thought he was crazy. And one day, in the middle of a talk, he pulled out a condom, and without realizing, he unrolled it. And everybody started to titter in the audience. So he realized he had their attention. So he did what inevitably boys will do with a condom. He blew it up, and then everybody was just screaming with laughter. And then he passed out condoms and had them all blowing them up, had a condom blowing up contest, and this spread around the country. He got the message across by making people laugh, by bringing out in the open something that is usually kind of an uneasy subject, and by making good economic sense.
Well, and the economic sense was a crucial question there, because even if you give people the power to not have children, which many cultures really hadn't had access to, and some cultures still don't have access to that kind of power right now, but even with that, he had women coming to him and saying, but there's no payoff to not having a child.
And, well,
Or multiple, many, many children.
You know, there are two different female responses to this one. One of them is the one that you just said. For poor women who are uneducated, that was oftentimes the initial response. They were still poor. So he realized that what they needed to do was give women incentives for having fewer children. And those incentives came in the form of microloans, and sometimes it was just loans of livestock. If you don't get pregnant for 2 years, you get a pig. And that turned out to work really wonderfully. It also incentivized women to start getting an education so they could learn how to take advantage of some of these, you know, cash infusions or you know, anything from pigs to edible crickets that they could get access to. In every country that I went to, rich country, poor country, it turns out that educating females is the best contraceptive of all, because educated women immediately understand that, first of all, they postpone their childbearing while they're in their studies. And then they've got something useful to do, interesting to do, helpful to their family's economy. They probably want to be mothers, but you can't exercise those skills if you've got seven kids hanging on you. So overwhelmingly throughout the world, the average number of children that a woman who gets past secondary school has is two or fewer. And in many countries, that's the reason why population came down. So, you know, I go to the Vatican for this book, and I don't have to belabor the case of what the Vatican's opinion is about using contraception. But the Vatican is surrounded by a Catholic country called Italy, which has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet because it also has probably the highest per capita education rate of females. There's more female PhDs in Italy per capita, I think, than anywhere, and certainly more than there are male PhDs. And you know, they want to be mothers, but they don't want to only be mothers. So these are things that not only could help alleviate the pressures on the planet in an environmental sense, but they can alleviate so many of the social pressures. Tapping a female talent by making education available is really one of the most resourceful things that we can do towards the future.
I'm talking with Alan Weisman. His latest book is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And Alan, you bring up Italy, and that brings up a lot of these developed countries where the birth rate has declined dramatically among many groups. But there are also a lot of immigrants coming into these countries. And in many of these smaller cultures, the birth rate has not declined dramatically. And there are people who, of course, are terrified of that. We see a lot of xenophobia. You show us examples of Islamophobia in Germany, but it's everywhere. It's in all of these developed countries where there are these groups of immigrants, and people are frightened that they will outproduce the natives and take over the land. I mean, did you find a lot of examples of that? And of course, when you see those examples, you also people are edging closer and closer to eugenics when they talk about trying to control that population's birth rate.
Well, you know, the history of contraception is, you know, unfortunately linked to eugenics. Eugenics was a movement that in the early part of this century was worldwide. The idea that you want able-bodied, smart people to be breeding with each other. I mean, you know, it was a cloaked form of not in a very thinly cloaked form of racism. It was a cloaked form of discrimination against all kinds of less desirables. And there were some pretty bad euphemisms like that one that were stated not just by the fringe, like we hear them today, because today xenophobes are fringe characters. They're loud and strident, and we hear them more than they really deserve to be heard by the percentage that they represent. But back then, eugenics was taught in major universities. The major textbook from it came out of Harvard, you know, Oxford, Yale, you name it. You know, this was what was, you know, believed to be the truth. And, you know, here in Iowa, Kellogg's Corn Flakes. The Kellogg Foundation was one of the biggest promoters of eugenic studies throughout the United throughout the world, actually. So this is something that was the way the world was. And contraception, of course, was an easy way to, you know, decide who got to have babies, or forced sterilizations. Now, we've come a long way since that. There's very little forced sterilization going on anywhere in the world anymore. But we do still have the problem of, as you stated, you know, this xenophobic fear that all of Europe is going to become a Muslim country. You can see this all over the internet.
And you see it in the United States, too, with this idea that, you know, Mexicans will take over, Hispanics will take over. I mean, you hear this in almost every developed country around the world.
Well, look, these immigrants come from what have been rural countries. And rural populations everywhere, including in this country, always had large families for the reasons that I stated earlier. And once these immigrants get to a developed nation, and particularly when they have access to education, those high birth rates start to fall very, very quickly. You know, I interview young Muslim women in the UK for this book. I talk to people in many different countries, and Yeah, they may have come from a family of eight in Bangladesh, but these girls see what the future is, and they're only going to have two kids. I hear that over and over again, and the demographic statistics bear that out. But yes, of course, there are a lot of immigrants that come in because their country's overpopulated to the point that, you know, they couldn't feed everybody and they couldn't employ everybody. And it takes a generation or almost two generations before, you know, that old overgrown generation in the beginning dies off, and the smaller ones start to, you know, who are having fewer children, then start to bring the numbers down.
Alan, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Alan Wiseman. He's the author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Alan Wiseman. His most recent work is the book Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. He'll also be speaking tonight at Iowa State University in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 8 p.m. And we're talking about many of the very difficult questions facing our species, facing our planet this hour. And we'd love for you to join the conversation as well at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. And Alan, in just a moment, I do want to talk about some of the serious problems that economies face as populations decline and how we can plan for that in the future. And also, very importantly, our place in the ecosystems of planet Earth as well. But we do have a few people who want to join the conversation. I'll get first to Danielle in Woodward. Hello, Danielle.
Hi, Charity and Alan. Thank you for taking my call. Alan, I've been teaching environmental science and ecology and environmental ethics for 20 years, and I'm wondering if we're hearing similar things from the demographics that I teach, the late teens to early 20s. And I'm rather astounded that when they contemplate the data, they're convinced that warfare and disease is what will reduce the population. Most of them are unhopeful that humans will choose intelligently to engage in rigorous family planning. They ask me what my solution is, and my pat answer is civil rights for women globally, no excuse for culture or religion.
So well, Alan, are you hearing that as well?
You know, a lot of people feel that it's going to take a catastrophe to get our attention, and we're already moving into a potential climate catastrophe, and it's gradually starting to get more and more of our attention. So there's obviously some truth to that. What we hope, though, is that the catastrophe won't be so overwhelming that it'll get our attention too late. In the meantime, though, there are things that we can be doing, very effective things that could really make a difference sooner. So I'm not ready to give up. And when I hear this from young people, you know, I'm at Iowa State today. I'm meeting with a lot of young people, and these questions are coming to me as well. One of the things that I point out is that we don't need any technological leaps to learn how to deal with the number of consumers of all this energy that are causing all the problems, putting pressures on our ecosystem right now. We may not be adept at having a massive uptake of solar and wind energy throughout the world yet. We don't have the technologies that are mature enough, and obviously there are huge forces in the petrochemical industry that are working against that. And we have to keep dealing with that as best as we can, and we have to get a lot better at that. But in the meantime, contraception is technology that we already have, and it turns out to be in everybody's economic interest to have fewer kids rather than a whole lot of them. It's just a lot easier to feed, clothe, and educate them. And some of the countries I went to, like Iran, brought their population that had run amok after they tried to build a 20-million-man army to fight off the invading Iraqis, simply by encouraging women to stay in school and to make contraception available to them, they brought themselves down to replacement rate. That's two people having two kids essentially replacing themselves a year faster than China did with this one child policy.
Well, and that you mentioned that it's economically better off for a family to make that decision. But let's talk about China, because, you know, obviously China has had this one child policy for some time. And now, although China is a huge country with a huge population, there are serious economic problems that families are facing today, because if you are an only child and you marry an only child, then those two people are responsible for the care of their aging parents and often their grandparents as well. And that's a very difficult economic structure to maintain.
You know, it's a challenge, but it's not a disaster by any means. You know, what do you call an economic problem in China? They're still growing at around 8% a year. That's a breathtaking place. I have been in many Chinese cities. You know, there's now 125 of them that are over a million. And you know, we Americans would be amazed at, you know, it's not that they're catching up to our development. They're way beyond us in many ways. Yeah, I know a lot of young Chinese who find themselves being, you know, part of the support system for parents and grandparents. By the way, that's also helping to end discrimination against female children, because it turns out that female children are more attentive caregivers to the elderly. This is going to even out after a generation or so, as there are, you know, again, as the big bubble of the one-child policy generation, that dies off. And it's going to be easier. And in my book, I talk to one of the originators of the Chinese policy, who is now been hired by the government to come up with ways that society can learn to help take care of senior citizens in the case of a shrinking population, which China inevitably is going to face. Japan is already in that situation for reasons, again, that I explain in the book. And ultimately, economists who aren't, having a knee-jerk reaction to this are realizing that there are some great economic opportunities for the country, and there are ways to reorient some of society's expenditures to help take care of a generation or two of a lot of senior citizens. You know, frankly, I can think of a lot of things that my country has been spending money on that we could reorient to the care and feeding of senior citizens for a generation or so, that if we hadn't spent it on other things, like what we were doing in Iran and Iraq for the past decade, might be much more well spent. Taking care within a small family or within an entire nation of the elderly is not the onus that oftentimes it's portrayed to be. And I'd point out, too, that senior citizens are much more economic. They're healthier these days. They're much more economically productive beyond traditional retirement years than kids are. You know, children cost society a lot of money. You have to feed them, clothe them, and educate them before they start contributing to the economy.
Let's get back to the phones. Bill is on the line in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Well, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call. Alan, you mentioned Dr. Norman Borlaug, when he received the Nobel Prize, that he stated that there are two sides to the human equation, food production and population control. And the World Food Prize Organization, as you know, recognizes food production researchers but does nothing on the population control side of that equation. What do you think of the World Food Prize Organization taking the lead on the population control issue if they are to truly follow Dr. Borlaug's philosophy?
Well, I think it would be a nice idea. You know, I, among the many places I went for this book, were to the two Green Revolution centers, the Center for Wheat and Corn Improvement that he founded in Mexico, and then the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. And in both places, they told me that, you know, we're faced with, in the next 50 years, producing more food than has been produced in the whole human history. And nobody there felt that the technology, food technology, was going to be able to solve those problems unless population were gracefully and gradually brought down to a sustainable level. They all thanked me for being there to raise that question. And, you know, in the Vatican, I had gone there for the obvious reason, but also because Pope Benedict had issued an encyclical saying that there is food enough for everybody on this planet if we all share equitably. And I asked him, how are we going to produce all that food? And we already got 1 billion hungry people, and we're scheduled to add, you know, more than 2 billion by the middle of the century. And they said, well, transgenic plants that are being developed at the Green Revolution centers. And they're trying to do that in those centers. They're trying to kick up photosynthesis to create even more energy, plant energy. But they all said, this is 20 to 30 years in the future, even if they're able to do it. And by then, there's 2 billion more. And they're frankly worried.
You write a lot about our place as humans in nature, on Earth. And I think that that's something that we as humans tend to take for granted or overlook. We see ourselves as apart from nature. But that's something that, that you feel we really need to understand if we're going to have a successful future on this planet.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned early in the book, and I start this book, by the way, you know, in the most volatile place that I could find, Israel and Palestine. You know, our attention is focused on them already for reasons of either, you know, religious tradition. It's hallowed ground to three of the world's great religions. And also because the Palestinian and Israeli conflict is so huge. And yet nobody really, you don't hear too much about the fact that that conflict is largely an ecological conflict. Israel's settlements on the West Bank, they're all on top of the major aquifer there. They're on top of wells. And this is why Israel does not want to give them back, even though everybody tries to tell them that it's just ridiculous to have all those settlers in there and being an obstacle to an equitable two-state peaceful solution. I point out in the book that before the State of Israel was created, the British ecologists, because it was under British mandate, estimated that the carrying capacity of Israel was about 2.5 billion people. David Ben-Gurion, the Zionist first prime minister, argued that Jewish ingenuity could make the desert bloom, and that he thought they could fit more than twice that, 6 million people. And today there are 12 million people there, and by the middle of this century it'll be 21 million people the way that they're growing right now. And you hear people talk about this technological optimism, and they oftentimes point to Holland. You know, the Netherlands is the most densely populated country in Europe, and you know, it's an artificial environment now, and yet they have a very high standard of living. But both the Israelis and the Dutch depend on things that only an ecosystem can give us. And they have to import those things from somewhere where there is a viable ecosystem that can, you know, here's a very easy example. Everyone in this agricultural state can understand, and that's pollination. You know, we are deeply dependent on other creatures to pollinate a third of the food that we eat. And a lot of our pollinators, from bats to bees, are now very, very threatened species. If we lose them, what's going to happen? There are many more examples in my book.
I think a lot of people, when they think about environmental problems, feel overwhelmed and helpless, as if there's nothing that they individually can do to really make a difference. And one of the messages that I take away from your book is that you feel that individual reproductive decisions, no matter where you live in the world, are our most important decisions as far as our future on the planet. Is that, am I reading you correctly?
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that each of us can affect, you know, affect personally, and we can affect politically by simply emphasizing to our politicians that one of the great things that the United States does with our tax dollars is provide contraception. We are the biggest provider through USAID of contraceptive services throughout the world. And yet that is a, as I mentioned earlier, a very fragile fact because, you know, I'm not a member of a political party, but President Obama's opponents in the last presidential race were very clear about wanting to cut funding for those services for ideological reasons. And this just doesn't make any ecological sense on this planet right now. If you don't like abortion, great. The more contraception out there, the fewer abortions there's going to be. Several demographic institutes have come up with figures showing that, you know, there's now 40 million abortions on the planet every year because half of pregnancies are unintended. And if contraception was universally available, that number would come down to 14 million. That would save us 36 million abortions a year. That's a pretty good anti-abortion program. This is cheap stuff, and this is something that we have to tell our congressional representatives. To provide universal contraception for everyone in the world to make the decision whether they want to use it or not would cost less per year than the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan during much of the last decade, slightly over $8 billion. Right now, you know, we're putting in about half that amount. This $8 billion is not much money these days on this planet. This is eminently affordable. And this is something that in our personal lives we can do too. You want to have a large family? You absolutely can have one. I have neighbors who have 9 kids, and it's a very happy family. 2 of them are biological, and 7 of them are adopted. One resource we're not running out of this planet, is kids who need a home.
Do you find yourself feeling optimistic about the future?
I'm more optimistic than when I went into this book because I realize that not only is this something technologically already accessible to us and extremely inexpensive, but there's great momentum for it in this world. Nearly half the countries of the world are either at, below, or approaching replacement rate right now. And this idea that if you have 2 children, you're not increasing the population, puts a lot of people's minds at ease that they're not being coerced to only have 1 child. It's happening in poor countries and it's happening in rich countries as long as contraception is available out there. And if you add female education to it, it's even better. And that gives us even a better chance for a better future.
Alan, thank you so much for talking with me this hour.
It's been my pleasure.
Alan Weisman is the author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And he'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 8 p.m. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, I'll talk with our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally. This is Talk of Iowa.